Welcome to DevMode.fm, a podcast dedicated to the tools, techniques, and technologies used in modern web development. I'm Patrick Harrington from Mildly Geeky in Boston.
I'm Andrew Welch from NY Studio 107.
I'm Jonathan Melville from MDD in Atlanta.
I'm Matt Stein from Working Concept in Seattle.
And I'm Michael Rogg from Top Shelf Craft in Texas.
And today we have on Jen Bloomberg, co-founder of Next Solutions. Jen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So today we are going to be talking pricing medium to large size projects. We want to keep everything, I think, pretty open today. Just go back and forth, talk about how we approach business development on medium to large projects, and then, yeah, how we price them. First, Jen, tell me a little bit about yourself, a little bit about Next Solutions.
Sure. So I'm a software development and co-founder of Next Solutions. We do, we're sort of a combination between a software development agency doing custom work for hire projects. And we also have a few products that we sell in a software as a service type of model. So we're a team of 8 people, and we work with usually nonprofit organizations or government agencies, and are starting to work with businesses now as well.
Okay. And you're in the greater New York City area. Do you keep everything pretty local? Are you someone that's gotten outside of New York?
So our team is fully remote. So normally, at any given time, we'll be in 5 or 6 different countries, which is pretty cool. And we work with organizations in Canada, where we're headquartered, the US, Australia, New Zealand, South America as well. So we're trying to just dominate the world, as you can see.
I love it. Yeah, I'm looking at your LinkedIn. It says here that you have 3 nationalities, 3 languages, and have lived on 5 continents.
Yeah, I should probably take that down. I feel like it's a bit much, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it's impressive. Great. So yeah, tell me a little bit more about how you got interested in, you know, medium to large size. I mean, this episode kind of, I think, came about through some discussions over the now defunct Craft Slack, which has been overrun by Slackbot. And, you know, we all stand fearful of the Slackbot. And, you know, now maybe on Discord we can have discussions. But yeah, tell me a little bit more about how, you know, I don't know if I was there for the original discussion, but, you know, this episode really, I think, came about from some discussion you had with Andrew. That's on right. Pricing medium to large size projects.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really speaks to the openness of that Slack, which I guess is now Discord, in that people are people feel comfortable to be able to talk about things which are often private. And pricing, I think, especially in our industry, can be quite opaque. Mm-hmm. To give an example, before we had this discussion, I was helping a friend of mine who works for a decently large size magazine in New York, and they had procured quotes for a web redesign. And she had asked me to explain the difference in the 3 quotes. For the exact same thing, there was a $20,000 quote, a $45,000 quote, and then an $80,000 quote. And I could not, for the life of me, explain the discrepancy in what was being offered and the price. So yeah, they were all planning to do a, you know, simple CMS, WordPress often. There didn't seem to be any fancy rocket science in what was going to be delivered. And yet the pricing was 4X. You know, the highest price was 4X what the lowest price was. And
sure. I can tell you the difference, Jen. The difference is that the one that put in the 80 grand bid, yeah, they've got an espresso bar at their agency.
and free foosball table and some, yeah, and they do your laundry.
Yeah.
But it really got me thinking about our own agency and how we price projects. And I realized that I didn't really know how other agencies price things. So it would be good to talk about. And then it seemed like on the channel that other people were interested as well.
So to frame the discussion real quick, when we talk about medium to large size projects, we're talking about projects that are into 5 figures and occasionally bleeding over into 6 figures, right?
That's right.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I mean, the way that I think about it is not always about the price of the project, but also just the size of the company. And, you know, I personally don't do work at this point for small, kind of definitely not mom and pop operations, as well as, you know, it comes down, sometimes you get a request from someone and they're definitely not a mom and pop anymore, but you also know that you're not going to be able to develop, to give them the value back that they're going to pay for your rates. So I think it's also just, you know, getting to that next level of project and seeing that and being able to then bid on those projects. And I think it's two things. It's probably there are people listening today that are going to want to say, I would love to be able to bid on those projects, but right now I don't feel like I can. I don't feel like I have the team size or the experience working on those projects. And then also pricing. So I think we'll talk about both.
Well, you know, I was recently contacted by someone who's on a smaller team, but is bidding on a very large project. Mm-hmm. Right. And instead of saying, you know, I don't know if we're ready to bid on that, what he started doing was reaching out to people, including me, so that he had a team ready if lightning struck and they got the bid.
Yep. You know? Yep.
So, I mean, that's a way to do it. But why don't we talk about the different ways that we can try to go in and determine pricing for these kind of medium to large size projects? So one way is hourly, right? What does everyone think of hourly?
Very, very difficult to do this accurately. I mean, when you consider, I sort of think about it like doing a home renovation, if anybody's ever done that. I mean, you can sort of scope it out in your brain all you want. Like, hey, I think it's going to go this way. We're going to go in. It's going to cost this much to rip the countertops out. And then, but inevitably, when you take that wall down, you're going to find that asbestos you didn't think about or whatever. And so, you know, you can do your best to kind of ballpark a large or medium or large size project in terms of hourly, but this is very difficult to do. I find that value pricing is much more effective way to do that.
What is value pricing?
Well, wait, before we go to value, we should clarify that you can price hourly in the sense that you can estimate and even fix the price on a project based on how many hours you think it can take, but also you can bill time and materials, and in that case, your client is basically writing you a blank check for some amount of time, be it a day at a time, a week at a time, a project at a time, to just do the work, and that's a lot safer, but a lot harder to sell.
Yeah, because it's open-ended, right? Because hourly, in some sense, Jonathan, doesn't hourly protect us? From the scenario you're talking about, you know, if we do get in there and we do find that it's going to be a whole lot more work, aren't we protected because we're billing hourly and we just are going to bill them for however long it takes?
That's different if you're saying if you have like this open-ended pricing structure where you tell your client, you know, my best guess is I think it's going to cost this much, but you know, who knows what, you know, when we get into it, if you know, we're going to have to rack up more time, and the client's totally cool with that. I was just saying if you like have this hard and fast estimate where you're like, my estimate is it's going to take me X amount of hours at this cost. And then the client expects that that's exactly what it's going to cost them. And then it's just up to you to eat the rest of it. If there's some surprises, I think that's where you get into dangerous territory with hourly.
That's like the worst of all worlds. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's hard once you get into medium sized projects. Time materials is good when a project is truly nebulous. You don't know what the scope is going to be or how long it's going to take. And I think the biggest thing, I know some very successful business people that run their entire operation time and materials. I think you have to give an estimate. You have to then give the client frequent updates on how you're tracking against that estimate based on what you thought it was going to be. There's a lot of overhead that going into it. And it also means that, you know, that you're never going to be underwater on a project, which is nice. The other side of that though, and this goes, you know, do you go hourly or go, you know, fixed bid or value, however you want to think about that, is that you also, there could be a project where you know that the project is worth a lot of money to this client. And because of your expertise and the tools, you know, you can build it pretty quickly and end up, you know, kind of separate yourself out from how long it takes to build versus what it's worth to them. And we'll get to that in a moment. So I think you lose the chance for that if you are sticking only with hourly.
And also, I think the larger the client, the easier it is to have this arrangement where you're like, you know, this is my best guess, but if we're going to go hourly, it could go up to this point. It could be more. We just don't know. The larger, more complicated projects and the larger clients tend to be more okay with that, whereas the more medium-sized clients are more protective of, you know, hitting this ceiling because they don't want you to just be able to rack up an unlimited bill for them. And
yeah,
so they're,
I think that's exactly right. Yeah. If you're working for IBM or someone that's, you know, has just money is maybe not no object, but they get to the point where time materials becomes okay for them again. Yeah. And they want to just make sure that every time they have a request, you're not going to hit them with a change order or a scope change, or this isn't in our initial fixed bid, you know, estimate. And they want to just be able to have you go and build and build and build. But I'd say I'm not at that point yet in terms of what I'm billing for, where we're just given unlimited freedom to just work on everything they want. And we usually end up in fixed bid and are just trying to, you know, it comes back to Jen's original thing of, is it a 20 or a 40 or an 80? Kind of what's it going to take us to build? What's it worth to them? How do we make sure we're not going to end up in the red on it.
I found that every client seems to respond pretty well also to something that's really simple, which is when you're setting up the contract, saying, defining exactly what happens if you get to the point where you've hit the upper end of your estimate. So they know, they have the assurance, for example, that you will stop and check in and have them guide what they would like done so that they don't end up with, you know, like a double or triple the budget surprise once you're all done and excited. That's usually
one of the things that I've been thinking about going into this episode is a lot of times when you get to medium and large size organizations is that they're willing to pay to mitigate risk. And I think, Matt, that's part of it. They want to know that it's okay if, you know, at some point you hit that, but tell us in advance. Make sure you never leave us with a project that is 60% complete because we end up spending a whole lot more time early on in the project and we didn't actually get something that's ready to push live or get out the door. Jen, what's been your experience? Have you worked with, you know, I'm very lucky. I worked for a large agency when I was starting out, which kind of exposed me to medium and large size organizations and specifically some very large nonprofits. Are those, when you say nonprofits, are you working with those larger ones? Or are they the smaller nonprofits or where are you working these days?
Yeah, at this point, we're working with larger nonprofits. We still work with quite a few of the smaller ones. And we find that the pricing model for them, we often have to do, you know, be creative with the pricing model, often not even allowing them to pay upfront because they can't, but they pay over time. And we used to do that quite a bit. Now we're sort of the mind that, you know, money now is better than money later, and we prefer to charge with value-based pricing. That being said, I think I agree with you guys that the smaller the organization, the more strict they are with their budgets. And our hourly-based pricing is quite easy to justify to them, especially if they're not that well educated in what they're purchasing, which I found with a lot of organizations, even larger ones, don't really know what the difference is between a website and a web app that actually does some fancy footwork. So I found in my experience with a bit of education, we're able to charge more value-based prices. The hourly based, it definitely does work because it's easy to understand. The one sort of big downside that I've experienced is that we end up getting compared to cheaper developers that they find on Elance or Upwork, and they don't really understand the difference between what we're offering and what they offer.
Sure. Yeah. And that's a tough thing. And if they're going based on price and they're looking for the lowest price, I mean, I think we've on the show talked about, you know, if you go through the lowest bidder, you can expect the lowest quality, but it can be hard for them because they may feel like a developer is a developer. And who are you to say that you're better at doing this than this other person who's charging, you know, $7 an hour out of a foreign country? And yeah, it's difficult. And if I see someone that's looking for that, we're probably not a good fit and they may need to kind of try out an Elance project first and then come back to me at a later date.
Come to you when it's blown up in their face. Yeah. Right?
And then it really costs,
you know,
a lot.
I don't think that the lowest bid isn't always the lowest quality. I don't think that is like just a good assumption. But what I know is that I don't want to be a participant in a race to the bottom. So, you know, it may be that there is someone just as qualified as me who, by virtue of their cost of living, has a much lower rate than I do. And that's fine. Like, good. Go build that thing and have it be successful. And you're not the right fit for me as a client because I have my cost of living and that informs my cost to you. So it's like, fine, cheap doesn't always mean bad, but sometimes it does. And I don't want to be on the hook if that's what it means. I'll just kind of bow out of that race.
Michael, first of all, no one compares to you. You're incomparable.
Well, thank you for saying so. You're not wrong.
Yeah. But I want someone to define for me, though. We've talked about value-based pricing. What does that mean? Tell me what value-based pricing is.
Jonathan, you want to go for this?
Well, I mean, I'll give you my definition of it.
Hey, you all are talking about this.
Yeah.
So you damn well better be able to define it.
I can give you some.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, in the simplest form of the definition of the word, I guess it would be instead of pricing something by the hour, you're saying, well, here is what my time is worth, like the entirety of my time and all the resources I'm going to have to throw at this project to get it done for you. The value of all of that, the sum of all of that, I see as this number. That's how I would define value-based pricing. Yeah.
I think it's easy for me to define value-based pricing based on what it's not. And it's not a price based on your cost plus margin to complete a project. Mm-hmm. It's a price that is based on the value that you're adding to an organization or to a project. So if, okay, so here's an easy example. Your current payment gateway charges you 4% per transaction, and Stripe is going to charge you whatever they charge, 2.7, 2.9%. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you want me to move your donation website from your current payment gateway to Stripe, which charges a lower rate, and you have $1 million in donations flowing through this thing, you know, every year. So 1% of $1 million is 10,000. Okay, so it may take me 4 hours to switch some API keys and write you a little plugin or something, whatever, that allows you to take advantage of this payment gateway that charges you 1% less. Well, in your case, that means that I just added $10,000 to your bottom line every year. So if you were going to pay me hourly, you might pay me $500 for that job, but I've added $10,000 of value. And so I might ask you to pay me a little bit more than I would if I were billing you time and materials, because the value that I've added to you in actual dollars is much greater. And so it's kind of a shift in perspective from how much does this cost me to do, and I'll add a margin and invoice you to that. And it's towards just a way of thinking where you really understand how someone's business or organization works and what the actual bottom line impact of your work is going to be. Mm-hmm. And you ask them to give you some of that value in exchange for your work.
And let me take a step now and say, has anyone ever priced it exactly like that, where there is a very easily calculated amount of revenue or new profit that's going to be brought in by a specific dev project? Because I found that that is a good way of explaining it in an academic sense, but in the real world, I find there's usually not something that is as black and white as that.
I think there was one. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Absolutely not. Go ahead, Jen.
there was one sort of eye-opening time when with a medium-sized nonprofit where they told us that with the system that we had built them, the system was basically doing the job of an admin person. Mm-hmm. So we thought about that, and in our next delivery of such a system, that was what we used to justify the price. Yep. And they actually, it made a lot of sense to them. I think you mentioned sort of shift in perspective. If you think about how much it costs to have an admin person do sort of these manual tasks, and you would have to hire that person, pay their benefits, and pay them for year upon year, then the cost of a medium-sized software project becomes a great deal from their perspective.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to put it. When you have an app or something where you can easily quantify and say, you know, a CFO spends, you know, 4 hours a week doing this task, our app is going to bring that down to a half hour a week, you know, take a look at how much you're paying. And then it makes it easy to say, okay, $599 a month is really makes sense compared to what we spend right now in terms of time of what this person has to do and what else they could be doing. I think where I find is value-based pricing is a term that gets thrown around. And for me, it's not so much that I've done the math and I've calculated everything and I've found that there's a number that is of value to the client, but it's more, it's kind of divorcing the worth or the cost of the project away from the sheer amount of labor that I think it's going to take and then what our typical hourly rate is. To me, that's kind of your floor of like, obviously, we want to make sure we're clearing at least this. But if we know from this client, maybe what sector they're in, what their risk tolerance is, that if I go $20,000 over what our cost is, it's really not going to phase them. And it's going to mean that I have some time to do maybe a few nice things for them that we know are going to come up, you know, just through the project. And I'm not going to have to ding them on every little bit of scope creep. And it's just, it's somewhere between there. It's like, here's what I think it's worth to them. Here's what my floor is in terms of my hours and hourly rate. And I find there's somewhere in the middle so that both sides are kind of winning.
Yeah, for what it's worth, my opinion on the value-based pricing is, so if someone wants to hire me, I can be a good little code monkey, and I can write the code that you need, and I can build a nice thing. But at least in my opinion, the value that I bring is being able to figure out what to do, right? And it's one thing to be given a task and say, implement this, but it takes a pretty good amount of experience to figure out, both from a biz dev perspective and also from a technical perspective, what would be the best way to tackle this problem and what technologies and practices can I use to build the best thing for my client, right? So I kind of see myself almost as like a CTO for hire that can also then get the work done. And that's kind of where I think that I bring the value. But I want to throw something out there to see if anyone else does this, which when you're looking at value-based pricing, do you also consider the value to you? In other words, if a project looks...
I was going
to
bring this up.
Yeah. If a project just looks awful, do you ever just jack up the price to a level where you don't really want to do it, but if they're willing to pay that, you're going to do it?
I've done that, but I've also done the reverse.
Okay.
So I've been in situations where I would be willing to take the work, but it had to be worth it for me because I knew what was coming. I knew what a headache it was going to be. And if they decided to walk, you know, I was fine with that too.
Yeah.
But I've also been in situations where I felt like it would be worth it to me to lower my estimate or my fee for doing a project because the project would maybe lead to more work down the road. And sometimes that's a very tricky judgment call because you don't want to feel like you are devaluing yourself. And there's this very rare.
And this reminds me of the trope of people contacting you and, you know, they're like, can you lower your price?
I'll give you equity in my company here. Yeah.
Well, yeah, they tell you it can be a portfolio item, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And that's why I was hesitant to even bring it up because this is like one of the most insidious traps that you can find yourself in as a designer.
I've had this happen where, you know, I did a project or I kept a client on an older rate for a long time just because they've been a good client. And they were good enough to make referral to a new client. I'm like, oh, great. And here's our rate, which is now our current rate. And they're like, oh, but your old client, they get this rate. And how come we aren't also being given this rate? So you also, once you devalue yourself with one project or one client, that may then, if they do have a referral, lead others to expect the same.
Yeah, I've only done it one time. And it was like a clear case where like I felt like it was going to lead to more work. I was actually right in that scenario, but I probably would not do that in 99.9% of.
Yeah. And I think the rule is like, you always have to cover your shop rate, right? You have to know what your shop rate is. And no matter what, just as a matter of principle, you always cover your shop rate. But
what is a shop rate?
Your shop rate is the amount of money that you need to bill per hour in order to pay all of your bills.
Okay.
So you've calculated how many billable hours you have in a year and what your expenses are in a year. And that is the minimum that you can ever bill to either a client or to yourself. If you're going to do something pro bono or whatever, like you just have to have that number in mind and you have to cover your shop rate always. But I think it's legit if I have a great relationship with a client and, you know, I'm trying to sell them on a giant thing tomorrow that I don't necessarily need to extract all of the value today that I might be able to if I was just going to really push it, right? Like maybe I could bill you five times my shop rate today, but it would make it harder for me to sell you the bigger thing tomorrow. So I won't try to ask you for all of that value today. I will let that relationship develop because I think that there's, you know, something better for us as collaborators that's on the horizon. Fine, you know, I'll only charge you 1.3 times my shop rate today. So you can adjust your margin to suit your sales strategy or your referral strategy or your client relationship strategy or whatever. Adjust your margin, but always cover your shop rate.
And I firmly believe that you become the kind of work that you do, right? So be careful about taking a lot of these, you know, quick or smaller jobs or jobs using older technologies where you don't think the future is. I really do think that you become the kind of work you do. You become known for it and you become good at whatever it is you do. I mean, something that I think Jonathan and I try to do is to push ourselves a little bit on every project to adopt something that is where we think things are going because we want to be known for that and we want to get good at that. Right, Jonathan?
It's the Wayne Gretzky strategy. You gotta escape where the puck's going to be.
Boom!
Yeah. I was gonna say, I'd almost rather like do a pro bono project than a, you know, heavily discounted project, because at least then you can say, okay, we're doing it to help out. Obviously, no one thinks you're going to be doing pro bono projects going forward for every project. And it's something where, you know, they may then really want to tell other people about you and say they did a great thing for us. They normally charge an arm and a leg, but they helped us out. I was an economics major, and there's some study about where if you had a pile of like Hershey Kisses and you told someone that, you know, they're 1 cent for a Hershey Kiss versus like 25 cents for some other chocolate, people, you know, they might be kind of fairly split between the penny one and the 25 cent one. But if you give someone, you know, something that's completely free, they're going to want that. And I don't know where this is analogy is heading, but I'm sure there's something there.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but I am shocked that Jonathan sets up the Wayne Gretzky analogy or saying or whatever, and that Jen, as a Canadian, doesn't chime in on that. What's up?
I was laughing to myself, but I just made sure the microphone was on mute. I appreciate the Wayne Gretzky. I appreciate the Wayne Gretzky analogy.
I actually did it. I did it for Jen.
Chocolate one. Yeah, thank you. I think the chocolate one is actually useful, though, because people do think that, you know, they are getting what they pay for. So if you charge them a heavily discounted amount, they're still going to expect to be able to call you whenever they mm-hmm. want, to ask for maintenance, to ask for updates, and to get that rate that they've locked you in on.
Yep.
Whereas, at least in my experience, the pro bono projects, you can kind of have fun with them and play around, and they're just happy. They've gotten something, they've gotten a great deal, and they, you know, I've gotten cases of wine from clients for doing free work, whereas I wouldn't have been able to charge very much. We kind of had a separate discussion later on about sending clients to, you know, Squarespace, if I'm allowed to say that here. but those projects wouldn't make us money anyway.
Sure.
So I think that the answer is you're not going to beat our shop rate. We'll probably lose money on them. So either do it for free or forego it for a bigger project. Yeah.
Yeah. And a version of that I sometimes find myself playing with is when there is some instance where there's some scope creep or even a new idea, like there's a new idea on a project that we want to pursue, but I'm not going to be able to build the client for it. But I personally want to pursue it, or I find it strategically important to pursue it. I will say to a client, okay, based on this adjustment, like this adjustment is going to generate such and such amount of cost. And in this case, I'm going to do that work as a gift to y'all and not bill you for it. But I will still send them an invoice for that work based on the normal rate. And then I will line item out that item based on whatever reason I want to give them for, like, I'm not going to bill you for this. But like that's kind of my version of, like, if I can't charge you what I need to for the Hershey's Kiss, but I still want to, like, give it to you, I will still invoice you for it so that you see that price tag. You see the value of what I've given you, and you understand that it took something from me to it. It wasn't just a willy-nilly thing that, like, didn't cost me anything just because it didn't cost you anything. I want you to see that number and understand that I've given you something of value. And then, you know, the next time something like that comes along, it's much easier for me to say, this is the value of it. And in this case, I'm not in a position to eat that cost. But you're used to seeing price tags associated with those little things. And that's kind of my version of, if I can't charge you what I need to, I'll give it to you, but I still want you to know what the value is. I still want you to register the actual value rather than a discounted thing.
Yeah.
So knowing that the value is there.
Right.
I think I've just started doing that with things like software updates and things that I do usually when I'm under the hood, like doing other things. Mm-hmm. And the client usually doesn't know, and I don't need to start charging in most cases, but exposing those things, exposing that value and at least giving them a clue that it's there is, I think that's...
Well, and you're doing them a service by building their pattern recognition around the costs of development or maintenance or whatever it is that you're doing. You know, that's part of the education, is them being able to kind of form the map in their head of what the costs are and when the costs are, even if there's, you know, you're not deducting money from their bank account.
I think something to keep in mind regarding value-based pricing. I think some people have some sense of guilt about, you know, if something only takes them an hour to do, you know, why are they billing so much money to do it? But the reality is that, or the irony actually, is that the better you get at something, the less time it takes you to do it, right? Yeah. But you would not be that good at it had you not put in all of those hours getting, you know, refining your skills and getting really, really good at it. And I think that that is even more the case when we're talking about higher level CTO-ish decisions, where it literally takes years or decades of experience to be able to come to a conclusion relatively quickly about what direction to take something in, you know, and they're just don't undervalue yourself in terms of the amount of work that you have done getting good at what you're doing. And also don't undervalue yourself in terms of how much work it took you to get to the place where you're at, where you're even able to make some of these higher level CTO-ish or biz dev-ish decisions.
Yeah, I think it's good to know, you know, from your client. I mean, I do research at times on, you know, what are their revenues? If they're a private company, that's a little bit harder to find, but if they're public or even if it's a nonprofit, you can see a little bit more about how they operate and what their margins are and try to understand what they're playing with. And the other thing that I, just to go back to what you said, Andrew, that I can't tell too much about of who this person is, but the best thing I ever heard, I was at a conference and someone was talking about a project they did that the deliverable was literally a document. I don't know number of pages. I can't remember. But it was SEO related. This client, a very large corporation, needed recommendations on platforms to use and not even, you know, like doing, you know, keyword stuffing or something like that. But they needed, you know, high level analysis of a technology landscape. The project is one that this person or, you know, working for a firm had done so many times, they literally could knock it out in 5 or 6 hours. But the value of that document to the client was $75,000. So that's what they billed.
Right. And probably in order to be able to produce that document, they had to spend a whole lot of time and experience learning stuff.
Yep.
Right.
They're paying for years of experience. And, you know, this is a corporation that's well known. And so they know that they're getting a good bit of analysis from them with their recommendation. And but yeah, it's you know, I've heard a lot of people that really insist on tying the costs to how many hours it took. And I think it's a little bit short-sighted. I mean, when Apple charges you for an iPhone, it doesn't cost, you know, what is it, $1,100 to make the XS Max. It, you know, might cost a few hundred dollars, but they know the market. They know what people are willing to pay. They're now getting some pushback and maybe people aren't always willing to pay that much. But yeah, it's more based on what utility does it give to you? How many hours a day are you spending on this device? What does it let you do that you otherwise couldn't do? And that, and then what is Samsung charging? What is Huawei charging? And that's where they can then settle on a price point based on the value to you and not, you know, the raw materials plus a margin.
Yeah. And you know, I think that's actually, you made a really good point. I think there's a really interesting balance between like the confidence of knowing your worth, but also the humility of knowing the market. Mm-hmm. And that's a balance that I find myself playing with a lot. And the iPhone is actually a perfect example of that, because when the iPhone came out, Apple's margins on a single iPhone were insane. And their margin on an iPhone, even the really expensive iPhones, just keeps going down because the market has adjusted and there's so many more competitors and there's so many more very worthy competitors who, in order to compete, are operating with less margin and or operating at a different scale or operating at it on a different plane of luxury or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like Apple's margins are going down. And I think it's really interesting to think about, you know, it can sound greedy to say like when you're the best at something, extract the maximum amount of value while you can. But I don't think that that's necessarily greedy. I think it's appropriate if you have invested in being ahead of the curve, that has cost you something. And knowing I'm ahead of the curve, I am providing more value, I should receive more value, but then also paying attention to know when the market has caught up and there are lots of other people who can provide that same amount of value. And, you know, being willing not try to maximize so hard on your margin because you're playing in a different market. And just like watching that time curve with different skills, right, or different stuff that we do, I think is an interesting conversation unto itself. Just like having both confidence and also market realism and humility when we talk about pricing.
In a concept of perceived value.
Right. Yeah.
There's a really good podcast called How I Built This. I don't know if anybody else listens to that, but where they just interview the founders of different companies to talk about it was like starting their company. And there's one that comes to mind for me where they interview the founders of Warby Parker. Really, really interesting. And one of the things just before, so it was like basically a college experiment for, I think, a business class or something. And at the point where they were actually making frames in an industry that has really, really high markup, they were about to launch with a product that would have been, I think, a pair of frames would have been like $10 or something. And they hired a marketing person that said, no, you can't do that. They'll be perceived as cheap.
Yep.
And so they raised it to $95, and you've probably heard of them already because they're doing great.
Yeah.
And they're still way undercutting the crazy margins that there are on frames. It was just a really interesting thing to hear.
Warby Parker? Never heard of it.
Again, it goes back to my old economics class. There was, a story of a dog walker who was advertising $5 a day to walk your dog or something like that and couldn't find anyone. Upped his prices to $20 a day and, was overrun with people who, we're looking for services. That I think if I was working in house at a client, I went to someone's website and they had a little pricing table that says, I've seen this on some very nice folks' sites, but we'll do a 5-page website for $499. We'll do a 15-page website for $800. To me, I would say I'm sorry, I don't think they're doing high quality work. They may be doing high quality work, but they're probably really undervaluing themselves if they are, just because that's not how people tie the worth of the website to, how many pages it takes or rates that
there's
are.
So there's a lot of copy and paste going.
But I think, I think Andrew's point earlier kind of feeds into this, which is you can't rest on your laurels. You have to keep investing in your ability to add new value. Mm. And you have to kind of like if you want to keep moving forward in terms of a pricing standpoint, you have to understand that you are not just a service provider, you are a knowledge provider and you're a context provider. And the thing that you sell isn't code, right? I'm very fond of saying, I don't sell code, I sell sleep. Sleep. Yeah. Like you will rest easier when your project is in my hands. You won't worry so much about overrunning your budget or not meeting your deadlines or not getting that promotion because you didn't impress your bot, like whatever it is that the real human value of my work is to the human on the other end of the line in a project. That's what I'm selling, is I'm selling their confidence about whatever it is that they are worried about or whatever it is that they want. Like I'm turning their question marks into periods, and that's the value that I sell. It's not the code. And so, if all you need is like an SEM rush report that tells you, whether your site has meta tags or something, you shouldn't pay me $10,000 for that report. You should.
Oh my God, you're destroying the business model of just about every SEO consulting firm.
You should go to the person who says, I can do that report in an hour and I will charge you an hour for it. If all you want is that automated report that takes someone an hour to do or whatever. But if I hire you, Andrew, I know that I'm not just paying you, fingers crossed, I hope, I'm not just paying you to run an automated report for me. I'm paying you to understand what that report tells you in the context of current SEO and SEM trends, in the context of my technology stack, in the context of my development process, in the context of my business model and the opportunities for me to improve my bottom line by seeing you. Like, I'm paying for that knowledge and that context that you have around the automated report that you're going to run for me. So it's not a good business decision for me to pay someone $10,000 for a report that I know takes them an hour to generate, but it is appropriate for me to pay them $10,000 to add $10,000 to my bottom line. That you have to see yourself in that way. You have to see yourself as not the person who's running a report, but the person who knows how to take the results from that report and add $10,000 to somebody's bottom line.
I've done the exact opposite a lot of times, that I've been called in to do consulting work and I'm working with a client and I see what they're paying these SEO firms to do for them. And I tell them to fire them and you should take the money that you're investing in hand tweaking keywords on a per page basis and put it into a good content strategy or put it into improving other parts of your site, because you're wasting your money, right? But Michael, when you said earlier that you didn't sell code, you sold sleep, like, I thought you were giving out Ambien prescriptions or something.
You don't need the Ambien. I'm saving you all of the money that you would. No. So let me, I would love to actually ask y'all for a favor, because I am probably, like, of the people in this room, I have the most to learn on this topic. So, like, when it comes to value pricing, I think I'm, like, still on step one of internalizing value pricing. For me, I think where value pricing sits in my schema is more along the lines of the Warby Parker story. When I learned about value pricing, what it did for me was it gave me confidence about raising my hourly rates, because I realized that the arbitrage between my hourly rates and the value that I was providing was so huge that I could be more expensive but still be relatively cheap compared to the value, right? That's and for me, like, I started my business when I was 12 years old, charging $5 an hour, and continued to, when you're 12 years old and you're trying to sell against agencies, you have to massively underprice and overdeliver. And I, like, continued massively underpricing and overdelivering for many years past when my expertise merited that I should, right? So I like underpriced myself for a very, very, very long time. And when I finally learned about value pricing, and I finally learned to think in terms of really understanding someone's business and the bottom line impact I'm having, what I, like, the benefit that I gained was that I got confident about raising my hourly rates. But I'm still not really confident about actually approaching value pricing in terms of actual value, because I don't really know how to work. Sometimes I do.
So I would say, like, I mean, and some of it, honestly, I think is people just throwing out numbers saying, clients of mine have raised their conversions by, 5% on average, and looking at what you have, then you can expect this. And some of that's a little bit magical thinking. One of the things that honestly I think has helped me the most, I've been very lucky, and I'm actually curious to go around to Jen and everyone else, but who here has worked at, let's say, like, a large agency, somewhere that is maybe like 25, 30 plus, that's actually still at the smaller end of things in many regards. But has anyone here worked at a large agency previously?
Not me.
Nope. Not me.
Negative.
Like, I've done big projects, but I've never worked at a big agency.
Jen?
No, I used to work at a management consulting company, which is sort of has a similar business model, but not a design or development agency.
Yeah. So I think one thing that I was very fortunate is that I started out a Boston firm here that does big, large, complex builds in Sitecore. Later, they went to Adobe Experience Manager. Worked at another. All I can say is that changed my calibration on what a project can be worth to a client. If anyone's known just what the software of Sitecore can look like, or Experience Manager, and
Experience, if they were working with Experience Manager and you were stuck in there, like, that would make me want to become a sheep. Yeah.
Okay. But so this is leading up to my ask to you, which is, I don't really have that exposure. And so when I'm working with a client that I already have a good relationship with, because I did some, like, hourly work for them and really proved my value, and now they really trust me, it's easy for me to have that conversation about the internals of their business so that I can really understand what my value is to them. Mm-hmm. If I'm approaching a new project, people are super cagey about all kinds of details that would be really valuable for me to know. So, like, how do you approach those conversations, and what are the actual, like, what's your strategy? Like, not for extracting secret data that you shouldn't have, but, like, to get someone to really let you into the internals of their business so that you can understand the value that you're providing to them. Like, how do those conversations go for super big projects?
Yeah. So I would say two things. First, I had the luxury of working for a couple of large agencies, and they're really great, well-run agencies. It's a great experience if you're just starting out, that if you get the ability to work at an agency like that, it can teach you a whole lot. The other part there, and I'm just mindful that there may be some folks listening that are thinking, like, forget about pricing these projects. How do I get these projects? How do I even get to the place where I can start to talk about $10,000? Like, right now I'm working at the scraps. I think it can also be good to try to partner up with a larger agency that needs some overflow dev work or has never worked with craft, and you show them how easy it is to use. because working with a larger agency can open a lot of doors into those projects. They may not be your projects. You'll be the subcontractor on them, but it can give you a lot of good exposure as well as let you start to maybe build up a team so that you then get to the size where you can personally take on those projects by helping a larger agency. The thing where you say that, sometimes someone's cagey where you're like, well, they have a business here, they're making some money, but I have no idea. Like, are they in the WordPress mindset where they want someone who's going to take a $50 theme and modify that a little bit and get out the door for $2,000? Or are they looking for really custom front-end templating, careful integrations, someone that's going to think through marketing automation with them and do all those things? So I usually just try to sniff that out on a call. Yeah, what I don't do anymore is I don't write up a full proposal. Like, if they tell me I don't have a budget, I want to see what's out there, I don't anymore go and write up a proposal and just kind of like grab the dartboard and like just try to guess at a price that I think might be amenable to them. I'll throw out a number and say, okay, if I come back with $50,000, is that going to scare you? That's literally the line I use quite a bit, and I can learn a whole lot based on that. Sometimes they'll say yes, oh my gosh, no, we were thinking of 20. It's like, oh, so you did have a budget.
Yeah.
Or if they say no, 50 is great, I'm like, oh crap, I should probably change that to 75. Okay. But that putting a number out like that kind of gets them into that place where they can really react to it. And sometimes you might see someone that says actually 50. If you think it's that low, maybe you don't understand the full scope of everything we're thinking of with this project. And then you can really get in and maybe find out that they have some weird ERP integration you need to do. And really it's getting into that, the six figure. Jen, what's been?
Jennabelle?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you made a really good point when you say that you got to throw out a number. I guess for the econ people in here, that's called anchoring.
Yep.
There's always a budget. And sometimes, I think it was Michael, you asked, how do you even go about asking? I think maybe one of the first steps you can do is ask and say, hey, what's your budget? Do you have a budget? And often they'll actually just tell you, yeah, we're looking for a range between, 20,000 and 30,000. And then of course, from there, you can decide whether you want to pursue that or pursue the conversation further and say, well, actually, what you're asking for is it's going to be difficult to do within that range. Are you open to a discussion about increasing the budget and go from there? A lot of it sort of depends on the rapport that you have with them. And if you really are finding that they're being cagey in a way that you think you might not really go anywhere, I agree that it's probably not worth it to spend a day or two of your time, which is worth, a certain amount of money, on a proposal that will go nowhere.
Right.
Yeah.
And to get to your point earlier, Michael, and also what you were talking about a little bit, Patrick, I mean, when I'm first working with a new client, the initial contact is almost entirely me learning about their business. Right.
Yep.
And because I think that's where I can help to bring in the value. And if that's not what they're interested in, if they're just looking for a gun to hire to build this thing, I'm not the right person for that job.
Sure.
I think that where I bring the most value is where I can bring my biz dev and technical experience together, where I can learn about their business and figure out the best ways to solve their problems for them. So the initial contact that I have with clients is always me learning as much as I can about their business.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, that's how I couch it to them as well, that in order for me to be effective, like, I need to learn about your business and I need to learn about your goals.
Yeah. And that is easy for me. Anybody wants to tell you about their business, like, I can learn conceptually about your business. And when I am really successful in sales, it's because I have been able to latch on and internalize the concept of your business and position myself as like a co-dreamer with you. Mm-hmm. I can pull the yes and, like, oh, that's cool. What if you did such and such? That would save you a bunch of money. Or what if you did such and such? That would open you up to a huge new audience. And conceptually that works. And if I can position myself as a co-dreamer with a client and get them really excited, then that's great. But I still, okay, I can save you a bunch of money, but I don't know the value of a bunch of money. And if I say, okay, so how much money would that actually save you? A lot of times they either don't know or don't want to tell me. And so that's, I don't have a budget. That's an easy situation for me, because you can, throw out some, okay, well, You don't have a budget. Is this a $3,000 project or a $30,000 project or a $100,000 project? And they'll, you know, you can tell by their face immediately, yep, like what the budget is, right? So like, fine. But I think it actually goes in both directions. It's not necessarily me seeing what value I ought to extract from a project. Sometimes it's from a sense of responsibility, just doing a high pass and figuring out if what I need to charge you at a minimum is even going to be worth it to you, if it is going to add as much value to you as I am going to ask you for. Because if not, it's just not responsible for me to do that work. And so it does go both ways. It's both, am I getting enough value from you? And also, am I giving enough value to you? But still, like, and Jen, you had some good words that I'm going to go back and write down and, you know, repeat verbatim with my clients. But like, How do you open up numbers? And maybe, like, I don't know, maybe a case study. Like, if anybody has, you know, an example that comes to mind of a project that they were approaching or bidding or whatever, and how you steered the conversation from, oh yeah, I can save you a bunch of money, to, okay, just how much is a bunch? What's your strategy for that?
Yeah, the other thing too, Matt, you haven't said too much here. What's been your...
I was going to say that I don't agree that everybody's eager to explain their business. And for me, that's usually a red flag is when,
right,
I like to ask questions, and that is my strategy for trying to learn more and figure out where my value can be for a client. Right. And it's easier after we've, you know, worked on something and we can establish a rapport. But I can tell immediately now, I did not pick up on this cue earlier, if somebody's annoyed by me having questions, or it seems like they don't have time, or they're not eager or excited to have me try and understand what they do, that's not going to be a good fit. That's not going to be a good client, because my value to them is doing a thing and then shutting up and going away. And that's I don't think that's great for anybody. So for me, I ask as many questions as I can. I think businesses and people's decisions on how to run them are fascinating. So I just kind of follow my interests and treat a disinterest in discussing the business as kind of a red flag. Not particulars, like, here's the maximum that we would be excited to pay for a Word document.
Right.
But, you know, I think somebody's response to my questioning says a lot.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the only thing that I can say, you know, sometimes you see someone that may want an NDA in place so they can speak more openly. That's obviously a very different situation, where they're happy to, but
that's fine though.
Yeah, I have heard some people that say, oh, I never send NDAs. If they don't trust me, then they're, you know, we're not going to work together. I think it's fine for someone to know that.
That's ridiculous. NDAs are completely standard. I mean, the one thing that I make sure that I do is I make it a mutual NDA.
Yep.
Where what applies to you applies to me, and it's fair, and away we go. But that's totally standard. You should never balk at an NDA.
Yeah.
You know?
Jen, you're the one that brought up this whole discussion and how to price medium to size. Do you feel, have we hit on it here? Are there still some things that are still, you know, feeling like we could go into further?
Yeah, I think it's been a really good discussion so far. But I think, I'm not sure if we've answered Michael's question fully yet in terms of how to get the actual number. And
maybe I can ask my question in a more specific way.
Yeah.
Which is like, if somebody, like, because clients are sort of, I'm never surprised when a client is cagey about numbers, because I'm sure they've been taken advantage of in the past. And, you know, if I'm new, it'll take me some time to qualify myself as not someone who will take advantage of them. Fine. Is there a way to ask about numbers without, or to find out about numbers without actually asking about numbers?
I think there is a way that you can approach it. You can arm yourself with knowledge before going into discussion, even by having a few great friends. I mean, you can just go around to the members of this podcast and say, this is what I think the project is going to look like. Can you give me a napkin sketch of what you would want to charge for this project? And usually, if you ask enough people, even just three or four, the numbers will triangulate to a point where you should be satisfied about what you think it's worth. And if you're armed with that knowledge, it can also help in your confidence when you're talking to the client, because if they throw out a number that's way off or way too low, you can know that something's not quite right, and that you have to continue the discussion and delve deeper into what exactly is missing between your sort of corroborated numbers and what they're expecting.
Yeah, to tie it back, I'm thinking of a project where I did just that. I had to kind of gut check where I had priced a project against someone else from the community. And it also goes back to the fact that I had originally done a lower price project for this client. And because of that, they then later wanted to do an e-commerce build with a heavy Salesforce integration. And so we end up kind of being anchored by that original project. And I remember I told this other person, someone I trust, how much we were doing for this craft commerce build, Salesforce integration, not just integration, but very, very deep integration. He was just like, oh no, you're not going to do well on that project. And that's the downside of a fixed bid when you end up, you know, kind of bidding on the wrong end of things. And for some reason you think it's going to be a lot easier than it is. It can definitely help to vet it against someone that you trust. And you know, maybe you want an NDA with that person, but everyone, especially in Shop Talk, is pretty good. And the world is big enough that we're not usually competing against each other on a project. Yeah.
Well, Patrick, you just landed a pretty sizable project. And without getting into any specifics, can you tell us how did you manage to do it?
So actually, it's one where we are subcontracting to a larger agency. So that goes back.
But you were competing with other people to get it, right?
Yes, as a subcontractor. Yeah, and honestly, I don't know exactly what it never felt like they were actively going between us and other bidders, is all I can say. So it felt like we had it. It took a while to close, months to close. But yeah, it's now occupying most of my waking days. But that's not a bad thing. It is the sort of project where at the end of it, you know, we priced it pretty well, priced it where we can do a lot of good things and deal with all the complexities that we're finding as the project goes on without having to change order to them to death. But then when there is a new big extra piece of functionality, we've also priced ourselves in a way that they know what the pricing is and they're ready to pay it. So I can't go into detail.
What do you feel
Well,
what do you feel it is that allowed you to get it? Was it that they trusted you and they knew that you were good and decided to do it? Or was it the proposal? Or was it just that they already have a budget and as long as what you're charging is less than a certain amount, like they don't really care? Like, what do you think allowed you to get that?
And I'm just, my daughter's sick and in the other room and she's calling for me. So I'm going to try to keep it quick because I think she's about to bust in. Yeah. We came actually in under what their budget was, which is interesting. Not like criminally low or anything, but to the point where it helped us close it. From the beginning, we demonstrated a lot of knowledge about exactly what they're doing and how we would do it and made them feel from the start like the project had already kicked off and we were there ready to, be with them and already understood their project, even in the proposal stages.
I would love to hear from someone. You might need to bust out and go help your daughter. But because the podcast isn't selling medium to large size projects. We've talked about that on episodes before. It's pricing medium to large size projects. So maybe we should steer back towards that direction. I would love to hear how you actually priced, because I know what my strategy is, but I'd love to hear y'all. What is the flow chart of how you price those projects so that you can do good work? Like, what questions are you asking yourself and how do you stage that out with discovery and proposals and stuff? Like, how do y'all actually price a project? Give me an example.
Jonathan, you've worked on some pretty decently sized projects. How do you do it?
Just extensive discovery process. So my goal is always to eliminate surprises because I think surprises are the ultimate boogeyman when you start getting into projects that are medium and larger sized. And so just mitigating my risk of losing time, of losing money on that project. So I think just being really thorough, asking as many questions as you can of the client, getting them to explain their ideas as clearly as they can, and trying to sort of document the scope of that project. So
how do you get the number? How do you get the number?
The number. Well,
is it what you can get away
with? I don't charge per hour, but I have a pretty good idea of I'm pretty good at estimating how long something will take. I do take that into account, but I also tend to take value into it as well. Honestly, it's like a little bit of alchemy with me. I don't have a hard and fast rule for it, but the baseline is how long I think it'll take me compared with the value to the client.
I mean, the simple answer is you want the number to be as big as it can possibly be that would still be accepted, right?
So that's exactly right. That is the simple answer. Yeah, absolutely. But also you don't want to feel like that you are taking advantage either. So even if the client is maybe willing to pay this, is this really what I should be charging them? I feel like that's always a delicate.
One thing that Jen had put into her notes in prep for the show was Mike Montero's, and I'll keep it G-rated, but it was F you pay me. A great talk he did I think Creative Mornings talk a number of years ago, talking about the importance of being paid and charging for your work and having contracts. The other thing that I'll note too, Mike Montero has a book called Design is a Job that we can link in the show notes.
Great book.
If anyone hasn't read it, it's terrific. It talks about taking yourself seriously, being good about contracts, being paid what you're worth. It's one of the A Book Apart books, and one line in it that he has, I'm going to paraphrase, is that if you give your client a quote or your rate and you slap them across the face, if they're complaining about the slap rather than your rate, that's a problem. And again, a little bit of a funny quote, but I always think that you need to get to the point where people are haggling and trying to get you down in price a little bit. If you're having far too many of your prices just accepted on your first price point, it probably means you're not charging enough. Clients like to haggle. They're not going to be deeply insulted by you if you come back at a price that's maybe in a little bit higher than what they wanted, or they just want to get you down in price a little bit. But if they're saying yes from the get-go far too often, then you're probably not charging enough.
Wait a minute. So you're going out there and you're slapping clients? I can't imagine Jen
only
is going
to do
that as a very courteous... only metaphorically.
Yeah, Mike, I read your book and I'm losing all my clients. I can't figure out what I'm doing wrong.
Now I need a lawyer.
Right, so you give your client a quote and then you tell them their hockey team sucks.
Oh.
Wow, that's probably worse.
Which to the
you drop your stick, you drop your gloves, and you go at it.
Actually, wow. You know what? Now that I think about it, we've been talking about how nice Canadians are, but then they nationalized a sport that is basically beating people up. Like
that's where they let it all out.
Like that, I now understand the full context of Canadian niceness is that they bottle it up and channel it into the fights in hockey.
Hockey fights are very polite, though. You know, they can get a little bloody, but they end when they're supposed to end, and everyone just kind of stands back and watches. And
they go in their boxes.
Yeah, they go do that.
Oh man, well, I feel like I feel like it is. It's alchemy, and it's always hand wavy. Like I have a hard time getting peers to explain to me how they price projects because it never seems to be like, not because they don't want to tell me, but because it's hard to actually self-analyze what the framework is. A lot of it is hand wavy and it's just from experience. Like you get a feel for these things and the problem is I don't necessarily have experience doing work for a Fortune 100 company for a project that's going to rake in 6 or 7 figures, but I would like for you to explain it to me. Like,
and a lot of it, the thing is just building on your older projects. Like you keep on kind of moving up and up, and you know, 1 year you're doing $20,000 projects, then you're doing $30,000 projects, and then maybe at some point you have a big jump and it opens up the doors to other larger clients. I think it's also a little bit of a ladder.
Yeah.
But for that initial pricing, I think it's hard to come up with the right number. We wouldn't have anything to talk about. I take the pressure off of it by almost always starting with a range. Mm-hmm. Like this is what this feels like to me. And usually the upper end of the range is comfortable for me and deeply uncomfortable for the potential mm-hmm. client. And mm-hmm. I say, okay, let's talk some more and narrow that range. And once we've talked enough that, you know, you can kind of feel out where their budget is by once you've got the range down to a point where they want to talk about what to do next, instead of having more conversations to get it to, you know, tighter parameters, then it's a dance, but I always start with a range of numbers, or almost always. Yeah. And that seems
it sounds
helpful.
Like you just want to be talked to.
Actually, that takes me back.
That's it. They say we need to get off this call now.
Right. So, I mean, I I feel like I might be doing it wrong because my pricing strategy is fairly straightforward, and I probably am leaving a lot of money on the table, maybe. But if someone, you know, approaches me with a mid-sized project, which I define as, you know, somewhere in the 5 figures, my strategy is I will spend a couple conversations talking to them about their business and just kind of, you know, like I say, dreaming with them about what it is that they want to build and how it'll impact them. And then I will immediately ask them to start paying me for discovery. And I ask them to pay me 1 day at a time for discovery. And I'll give them an estimate of like how long I think it will take for me to go discover the things. You know,
do you invoice them at the end of every day?
I will communicate them at the end of with them at the end of every day. So I'll invoice them at the end of discovery, but like I'll say at the beginning, okay, I think it's gonna, once I've got them sufficiently excited that I'm the person to do the work and that they want to do the work, then I'll say, okay, I think it's going to take me about 3 days to really dig into this problem, talk to all your stakeholders, evaluate the technical options, but let's take it a day at a time. My daily rate is sufficiently comfortable that to pay me a day at a time isn't a big deal for them. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like a huge chunk of money. And so end of day one, okay, here's who I talked to, here's what I learned, here are the questions I still have to answer. I still think it's going to take me about 3 days. I think that estimate was good. Talk to you tomorrow. End of day two. Okay. Talk to such and such people. These answers I got easier than I thought I would. Here's some questions that I think it might take me a little bit more time to answer. You know, talk to you tomorrow. Okay. End of day three. Okay, cool. Got all these answers. I think I need another half day. You know,
Michael, before we get into day 4 or 5,
the point is, I can get people to pay me for discovery because it seems like it's small enough chunks of money that
I could see it turning people off. There's so many off ramps where people are just like, okay, and we're at 3 days now. I don't know how many more days they're going to be. Like, yeah, there's so many points at which you're making them
That's why I think it's important to give them that mental progress bar at the end of every day. Like, okay, we expected to be about 30% of the way through our fact finding, and in fact, we are 30% of the way through our fact finding. This is going great, right? And that's usually how the conversation goes. It's a mental progress bar for them so that they can see it moving along, and I'm sharing with them what I'm learning because they're paying me to do that. And then at the end of discovery, I will have a pretty good idea of how many weeks it will take me to do that work. And I usually, I know my shop rate. I try to give myself about a 30% margin over my shop rate. And I estimate how many weeks I think it will take me. I give myself about a 30% margin over that. And I say, okay, here is the estimated cost of this project based on everything I learned in discovery. And that is what I think the price tag will be. And they will either fall or they won't.
All right. Let's see if we can get Jen in here. So I'm curious, Jen, do you charge for discovery when you're first engaging with a client?
We used to not charge for discovery and then realized that we absolutely have to a few reasons. One is it's work, and it's also valuable work because, as Michael described, you're doing a lot of stakeholder interviews, you're synthesizing it, you're putting together a fact sheet and an analysis of their business and their issues. So that's management consulting, or it's design, or it's software design. So that's work that should be paid for. And there's also been a few cases where people, if you don't charge for it, people may just take that discovery and, send it over to Upwork and get someone to build it. So it's important to charge for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say, Jen, is I've had it on numerous occasions where I've done a discovery process, and the discovery process figured out that they don't need me.
Yeah.
Right. Or they want someone. And so you absolutely should be paid for that. Right. For sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you find that people shy away from paying for it, that may be a indicator, a red flag of what they're going to be like to work with.
Absolutely.
So if they're not willing to, or they just disappear, then it may not be a good idea to work with.
I talked with somebody that treated discovery as I have a friend that has not billed for it in the past and has been a little bit burned to help clarify a lot of things and then not be able to recoup the cost of that. It's definitely not me. It's just a friend, but
it's definitely you.
But anyway, I talked to somebody that does charge for the discovery process, but also treats it as either discounts it for working on the project, or has some way of building that into the project to say, hey, you will pay me for this, but should we work on the project, which is really everybody's expectation, it will either be included or discounted or something like that, to kind of walk both ways and not shock the client, but then also protect that time in the event that the client decides they don't need you or want to go a different way with it. I thought that was kind of clever.
Yeah. Okay. So somebody critique my strategy, right?
Tell me where
my pricing is good. Yeah,
we got to save it for the next one.
No. We're at an hour and 20 minutes. Time.
Yeah.
Next podcast.
For the record, I'll say I haven't done the paid discovery thing, but now I want to. But
also concerned about Patrick's daughter.
I don't know.
Maybe
really
you should
quiet.
Go check out.
Watching, we've got Tinkerbell and the Pirate Fairy going
Listen,
on.
Listen, if your daughter is seriously injured, I'm going to blame Michael.
We all will. All right. And with that.
Sorry, Michael.
So that wraps it up for another episode of the Dev Mode FM podcast. Yeah, we're going out.
Oh my gosh.
To have every episode delivered to your favorite podcast player, subscribe to our RSS or subscribe via iTunes or Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify. I think we're on there now. Nope. Anywhere where you can
find
podcasts.
We're not on either one of those.
I mean, if you're listening, I hope you're subscribed. I don't know who these people are that listen without subscribing. And if you like what you're doing, please leave us a review. It's one of the best ways for other people to hear about us on the iTunes store. You can also follow us on Twitter. We are at DevModeFM, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on the episode. Give us a comment on the DevMode.fm website. For the DevMode.fm podcast, I'm Patrick Harrington.
I'm Andrew Welch.
I'm Jonathan Melville.
I'm Matt Stein.
I'm Michael Rogg.
And thank you very much, Jen Bloomberg.
Thank you for having me.
Is it Bloomberg or Blumberg?
You know,
did I say Blumberg?
It's actually both. We spell it with a U, so as not to be confused with, you know, the New York guy.
You know, you are much more accommodating. You're much more accommodating than than Vector Media, Matt Weinberg.
Oh yeah, he was very upset about the group thing, wasn't he?
He was very
Vector Web Design. Yeah,
yeah, he was so mad about the name of the company, and then he changed the name.
He was so mad about it, he had to find a different name.
We ruined the Vector Group.
This is also a very long
episode. Right, someone cue the music.
Right. Bye-bye. I apologize, Michael, but we were just getting way.
That's okay. We'll do it in the comments.